Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are new technologies changing what it means to be human? Less than a generation ago, our options for staying in touch were pretty much limited to the phone, letter writing, and good old-fashioned face-to-face visits. It was mostly only doctors who had instant messaging capabilities, and digital pagers and car phones seemed like revolutionary advances. We learned what was going on in the world through print sources, radio and TV, and we walked into the library to do research. Today, we can access virtually any piece of information we want instantly on the internet, which a growing number of us carry around in our pockets. 21st century teenagers are seemingly never offline and are as likely to be simultaneously texting, surfing, and checking emails during college lectures than to be taking notes with pen and paper. So how is all this technology affecting the evolution of modern society? Here's a sample from tonight's PBS Frontline special, Digital Nation.
In 2007, Frontline broadcast a film called Growing Up Online.
You need to have the internet on to talk to your friends because everybody uses it.
You can be more crazy online because there's no one watching to see what you're actually doing.
I had no idea what she was doing on the internet. That was a big surprise.
But today, it's not just our kids. All of us are immersed in technology all the time.
This is a digital moment in my life.
From multitasking.
Multitasking could be essentially dumbing down the world.
To the military.
It is a complete cultural change for the Air Force.
In work.
I mean, you've all met in real life at one point, right?
Actually, no.
And at play.
The first hour, I was hooked. I would play literally nonstop.
And on the virtual frontier.
The question is, are we entering a new paradigm? Or is this just the next best thing?
That was a clip from the Frontline special Digital Nation, which will air tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Television, Channel 13. Filmmaker Rachel Dretson is the producer of that piece, and she joins us now. Rachel, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
You talk in the film about this sort of epiphany you had one day when you looked around the house and realized the whole family was home, but nobody was really together. Can you talk about that?
Right. Well, I was cooking dinner in the kitchen, and I have three kids, and they were all on various forms of electronic media. My oldest son was doing his homework on his laptop, which is what he does now because he goes to a school that requires him to use a laptop. My husband was doing his work on his laptop, and my two younger kids were playing with my iPhone. And I just kind of looked out at them and thought, you know, we're all in the same room, but we're all in a different world. And aside from my two youngest kids, none of us were in those worlds together.
And what sort of research is being done into how all of this interaction with technology affects us?
Well, not enough, frankly. I mean, I think partly it's just that it's so early, and we're just beginning to really initiate the studies that we're going to need to understand how all this technology is affecting our brains and the way we think and learn and interact. There is a bit of science out there that's very interesting, and we profile all of it in the program. There's a really interesting study being done out at Stanford on multitasking, which looks at students at Stanford who are high multitaskers, the ones who are constantly juggling three or four different forms of media at the same time and think they're really, really good at it. And this is one of the striking things, by the way, about college students that we met. You know, they're all really confident that they can manage sitting in a lecture and at the same time going on Facebook and Googling something and G-chatting, you know, and that it's not disrupting their focus. In fact, what Cliff Nass at Stanford, who's studying this, who's actually measuring this, is finding is that the people who think they're the best at multitasking and who do the most of it are actually the absolute worst performing, which is really sort of counterintuitive, but when you talk to him, you begin to understand why.
And we're going to hear now a little sample from the other coast, and this is the situation at MIT.
I teach at MIT. I teach the most brilliant students in the world. But they have done themselves a disservice by drinking the Kool-Aid and believing that a multitasking learning environment will serve their best purposes. There really are important things you cannot think about unless it's still and you're only thinking about one thing at a time. There are just some things that are not amenable to being thought about in conjunction with 15 other things.
Yeah, well, I have 25 in the last 15 minutes.
I feel like the professors here do have to accept that we can multitask very well and that we do at all times. And so if they try and, you know, restrict us from doing it, it's almost unfair because we are completely capable moving in between lecture and other things and just keeping track of the many things that are going on in our lives.
So there, Rachel, we hear complete denial. That obviously the second voice was a student, does not acknowledge that multitasking gets in the way of her thinking.
Well, I just don't think she sees it that way. You know, these students, first of all, they're looking forward, and what they're seeing are jobs that require them to multitask, that are going to demand that they juggle multiple sources of media, that they be able to interrupt themselves constantly. And so I think they feel like they're getting really good training for that right now at school. I also think they don't honestly believe that there's anything lost when they're moving from thing to thing so quickly. And that's, I think, where they are wrong, as it turns out, according to the science anyway.
Yeah, and a lot of times young people will say, I mean, you and I can remember a time before there were all these opportunities to change things. But if you don't remember anything different, it doesn't seem like you're stressing yourself out.
That's right. I think that's really key, the generational differences between us. And to a certain extent, I think we have generational biases. One of the things I talk a bit about in the film is my own feeling about books being something very, very important for my kids. You know, I really believe that they should read, I hope that they will continue reading. It frightens me to think that they might stop. But we interview several experts in the film who say, you know, maybe reading isn't the most important thing going forward. Maybe there will be other ways of processing information and that we need to sort of be willing to evolve. And I think that's a really interesting question.
The reason a lot of people are stuck, I think, is because they confuse the old ways, the best ways of doing something once, with the best ways of doing those things forever. So it's not that kids shouldn't learn to communicate. It's not that they shouldn't learn to express complex ideas. Of course they should still learn all those things. Those are what we call the verbs. The nouns that they use, whether it's the essay or the paper or the writing or whatever it is, or whether it's the video or the podcast or the some, that's what changes. The learning may stay the same, but we invent new ways of teaching them. And I don't know that the book, which was for a long period of time, but not that long, maybe a couple of centuries, the way that people did this, that was the primary way, is the best way in the 21st century.
There's always gains and losses. You know, when print replaced oral culture, when writing happened, there are certainly things we lost. One of them was memory. And think of the Homeric poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey. The Homeric singers could produce thousands of lines of poetry out of their own memory. We're not good at that anymore because print took it away.
I think I really love that section of the film, Rachel, because on the one hand, they're right that we can't do that anymore. And we today in the 21st century don't miss that we can't do, you know, hours upon hours of spoken word, memorized
right.
poetry. But it's because we have no memory of the time when that was common.
That's right. And, you know, there's something really sad about it, you know, that our brains are changing and we may not ever know what it felt like to read long books, you know, in 50 years. That said, you know, there are all sorts of new things that we're able to do, new things that are really gratifying because of the Internet. And I think it's hard sometimes for those of us who didn't grow up with the Internet, people like me, to appreciate that. And that's one of the things I think that I tried to do in the program was just to be sort of transparent about my own sort of predilections, and give a voice to the people who really are looking forward and saying, you know, there's another way to see this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, too, because we are not digital natives in terms of our generation, and yet we've really learned to speak the language without much of an accent. You know, we're just as
right.
distracted as anybody else.
It's true. And actually, one of the reasons I wanted to make this program, my last program for Frontline, which aired 2 years ago, was called Growing Up Online. And this program was an outgrowth of that. And Growing Up Online really focused on adolescence. And it was after that show aired that I realized, you know, this is not just adolescence anymore. You know, the Internet is totally integrated into my life. And I find myself struggling, deeply struggling with distraction and multitasking and being constantly wired and my compulsion to be constantly connected, just as much, if not more, than my kids do. So, you know, I do think there's a bit of a sort of misunderstanding out there that this is, you know, an issue that kids have to deal with, when really I think more and more of us are struggling with it in our own lives.
We also have that sense, I think, that you know, we know how to control it and we know when to say enough is enough, but we fear that our kids won't develop those skills.
But I think it's not true. You know, mm-hmm. I think that less of us know how to control it than we pretend. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very hard not to check your email. Most people I know have a really hard time not interrupting themselves to check their email every so often. Sometimes sometimes every few minutes. And I think it can become really distracting, and yet we still do it. My partner, Doug Rushkoff, who is the co-correspondent on this film, who's a media theorist, describes feeling his thigh vibrate even when his phone isn't in his pocket, you know?
Yeah.
And I think we've all had that experience of thinking we're hearing our phone ringing. We're so connected to these devices. They're like extensions of our nervous system. And so, you know, I don't blame kids for having a hard time. You know, we do too, and we're way older.
Yeah, I think the best and worst thing that I have is a phone that allows me to check email and check the web and even check Facebook. You know, you could always lean into this machine and separate yourself from what's happening in real life.
One of the things that I realized as I was making this documentary was that this is true for both me and my kids, but probably more true for me, that whenever there's a sort of pause in the action or a moment of silence or just, you know, any sort of period of rest between activities, I go right to my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I might have just stood there and looked around, or I might have read a book, or I might have just kind of had whatever it is, I go to my phone. And I think that's you know, it's too bad, actually, because those moments of a pause in life are pretty valuable and restorative.
Yeah, there's some interesting writing being done now, and it doesn't come up directly in the film, but about, you know, creativity sometimes springs from boredom.
Right.
And we don't have any boredom anymore.
That's right. I mean, it's something I always say to my kids, you know, great, you're bored. That's great. I'm not going to solve that for you, you know, because I want them to figure out something to do. And it's true that when there are this many options, you know, there's no such thing as boredom, really. Even if we're doing completely meaningless, mindless stuff online, we're still doing it, you know. So it's, yeah, that's one of the things that bugs me the most about the internet. There are so many wonderful things, and they almost go without saying, you know, just the ability to connect to anybody, anywhere, and get information about anything, anytime. I mean, it's all just extraordinary. But there is this kind of strange way in which neurologically it seems to be changing us that I worry about.
I was struck by the number of students who describe what appear to be just really, you know, behaviors that seem very extreme in terms of their use of the internet and their Blackberries and things like that. And they're mostly, I mean, they sort of laugh about it, but they almost are boasting about it. And that's a really different approach than is taken in a country like South Korea.
That's true. Are you about to play a clip, or should I?
No, we're out of clips. They came up all in the first segment, so go right ahead.
They were good clips.
That was a great film.
Well, we went to South Korea in the film, actually. We spent quite a bit of time there. We went there because, you know, 10 years ago, South Korea was sort of seen as the next best, the sort of greatest example of digital culture out there. The Korean government wired up the country very quickly, very extensively, actually. There's universal broadband access in South Korea. I think it's 97% of the population has internet access and very high-speed broadband. So it's really part of their lives. And we went because we wanted to see sort of 10 years into their digital experiment, how they're dealing with it. And what we found was actually quite fascinating. The country has a professional video gaming culture. So, you know, there are pro video game teams who play in tournaments that are televised, and the pro gamers become celebrities in South Korea, many of them, and make six-figure salaries and just have gigantic following. And so alongside that professional gaming culture, there's just this gigantic amount of kids who play video games.
Let me have you pause right there because we do need to take a break. Rachel Dretson is my guest. Her film, Frontline Digital Nation, airs tonight across the country and here in Dallas and Fort Worth. It'll be on at 9 on KERA Channel 13 Television. You can join us after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Rachel Dretson. You can see her Frontline special called Digital Nation tonight at 9 on KERA Television Channel 13. If you'd like to join the conversation, send an email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. So before the break, Rachel, you were talking about South Korea, and they have this professional online gaming culture, but everybody else is wired right along with the professionals.
Right. And what's interesting is that because so many youth are so into video games, the Korean government has what they declare to be a public health crisis on their hands, which is that they have a culture of kids addicted to the internet. And they take it really seriously. I mean, the government has set up internet addiction treatment centers all over the country, which they fund for kids who they think are, excessively dependent on the internet. And they do a sort of digital detox, which basically is a very low-tech process. They just kind of take them outside, teach them how to camp and build a tent and talk to each other, and then they touch them a lot. They give them a lot of physical touch, which I thought was fascinating because it's clearly seen as an antidote to the just constantly online, disconnected experience that most kids have all the time without human contact.
Yeah, you feature one boy who goes through this program, and it's really striking that before his mom sends him off to this camp, he barely communicates with her.
Right. Actually, that was not shot before. That's the miracle of filmmaking. But, I think that I think this child, I mean, he's a really sad kid. He had been at the top half of his class, and he had sank to the bottom half of his class, and he was just doing nothing but playing video games during every waking hour. And he really saw his mother talking to him as just an interruption to his game, which is all he really wanted to do. But one of the other interesting things about South Korea, actually one of the more inspiring things, is that they have they've instituted a country nationwide internet education program, where starting in second grade, kids have to learn the civics of the internet, the rules of the road, how to talk to each other online, how to behave online, how not to get lost in video games. And, as far as I was concerned, it was a really interesting approach and one that I think we should think very seriously about here. I mean, obviously, we can't do the same kind of top-down education here because it's just not our culture, but I do think that kind of civics at an early age, before kids get to middle school and stop listening to their parents and their teachers, that's when we really need to start teaching them how to behave online.
Yeah, I was struck by the remarkable parallel between that sort of education and what we're seeing in this country in terms of nutrition. Because like eating, you can't go completely cold turkey from the internet and live, in the industrialized world for the most part. So they have to be taught how to make responsible choices.
Right. And, for some reason, I think when it comes to the internet, maybe because most parents and teachers are not of the digital native generation, we've sort of seen it as their domain and something we don't understand, and it's quite the opposite. I think they really need us to teach them netiquette, as the Koreans call it.
By the way, I was really interested to learn that the Korean word for click is kalik.
I know there are a lot of those kinds of funny Englishisms over there. So it was a very interesting trip, and we have to be careful to make too many comparisons because it's such a different culture, but definitely a lot to learn.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone and speak with Carol in Mesquite. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. As a psychiatrist and someone who's studied a lot about the brain, I'm intrigued by this whole notion that whatever technologies we are using, we really actually change certain patterns of connections in the brain structure itself.
Right.
Is that touched on in your film tonight?
Absolutely. We actually interview a neuroscientist at UCLA named Gary Small, who's one of the few people who's actually studying the impact of using the internet on the brain. And what he's done are MRI scans, fMRI scans, of people who are reading a book, simulated reading a book, obviously, because they're inside an MRI, so they can't actually read a book, and simulated doing a Google search. And actually, it's very interesting because what Small finds is very vivid. The many, many more areas of the brain are activated when you're doing a Google search than when you're reading a book. And so all the coverage after his study first came out, all the media coverage was saying, Google's making us smarter, and Google's good for the brain, and the internet's good for you. In fact, Small is the first to say that that's a massive oversimplification of what he found, and that actually he doesn't know that. He knows that our brains are very plastic and very sensitive to the act of going online. But he says, you know, it's possible that a more lean and efficient brain, which is what you have when you're reading, is actually better for us. We just don't know. And so I think that it's a good example of how some of this data can be misunderstood or misconstrued. It's also an example of how little we really know at this point.
And part of the reason that he thought the brain might appear to be firing on more cylinders or more synapses, as it were, is that we're simply making more choices with Google, but we may not be getting the depth of content that we would get in reading something.
That's right. That's a really good point. And I think that's really sort of hits at the dilemma when it comes to going online, which is we have so many more choices, so many more options. We do so much more, and I think it's thrilling to do so much. But the less quantifiable question of is some depth, is some analytic ability being lost, remains to be seen.
Can you talk for a minute about how the U.S. military is starting to use, in particular, virtual reality technology?
Sure. Well, the military has been really a leader in terms of virtual reality technology. They've integrated it into almost every aspect of what they do, starting with recruitment of troops, training troops, and then obviously on the battlefield itself, the military is using drones, which are operated from, you know, bases 7,500 miles away from the battlefield. You have airmen operating drones that are you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then they're actually, in a really interesting twist on all of this, they're using virtual reality therapy to treat troops who are coming home from the war with PTSD. And so they have a program called Virtual Iraq and a program called Virtual Afghanistan. And what they do is they have a therapist there working with the vet, and they create or replicate the trauma that the vet suffered in a virtual reality setting. So it's like reliving the experience in an immersive virtual way. And what they're finding is that it's remarkably successful at treating trauma, more so, in fact, than talk therapy, which is fascinating.
It's also astonishing the other side of that, which is that some of these remote drone pilots who are basically working from an office or a cubicle somewhere far from the battlefield are still occasionally susceptible to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right. And I think that's really interesting because I think it's probably a different sort of PTSD than the PTSD, and I don't know this, but than the PTSD that troops who are actually on the battlefield suffer. But it may actually be worse in some ways because these guys know what they're doing. I mean, they're wearing flight suits. The military goes to great lengths to make it clear to these guys that they're not playing a video game, that they are at war, that, you know, when they sit down at that computer screen, they are in Iraq, you know. And I think these guys take it very seriously. They know the import of what those bombs are doing. And then they have to get in their car and go home and listen to their kid talk about, you know, what he did at recess. And I think that disorientation is really disruptive to what these guys are doing, and very hard to handle for the human mind to handle when you think about it. When P.W. Singer in our film, who's an expert we interviewed in our film, describes, you know, how this is changing the definition of what it means to go to war. When you used to go to war, you used to, you know, leave home, go thousands of miles away. You were experiencing war, the trauma of being away from home in addition to everything else. And now these guys, you know, they never leave home. They go home and watch Lost on TV after they've, you know, dropped bombs in Afghanistan.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is filmmaker Rachel Dretson. You can watch Frontline Digital Nation tonight at 9 on KERA Television Channel 13. Let's go next on the phones to Kennedale and speak with Albert. Hi, Albert.
I want her to address the problem of the old people. I'm 70 years old. I've never used a computer. I don't even know how to get one or what to do.
Speaks to the question of the digital divide, I guess.
Have you tried going to a public library? Because, you know, most public libraries now will not only provide you with computers with access to the Internet, but they will teach you how to use them.
You did have a nice little moment where a grandmother is connecting with her grandkids using this technology.
Yes, it's one of my favorite moments in the show. It's kind of a late moment. This woman is she calls herself Bubby. Her real name is Bayla Shore, and she lives, well, I won't say where she lives, because I think she prefers not to be identified that way. But she and her grandson have an online cooking show called Feed Me Bubby. It was his idea. He created it, and mostly what happens is Bubby cooks, and her grandson films it, and she gives her recipes out to people all over the world. And it's become this kind of runaway sensation on the Internet, and she's attained this kind of, you know, fame in her older years. She's 83, and this is a woman who really doesn't have any experience with technology at all. I mean, she barely knew what a computer was before all this started. But it's really changed her life, and I think it's opened up her life in all sorts of ways, because now she has, you know, so many fans and also followers and people who share their lives with her. And it's been really gratifying.
So we talked about virtual reality as used by the military, but there is also a huge social component to this. And you know, it was really interesting to see the film Avatar and think about, you know, the ability, and of course, that's just a fictionalized account, but of someone to be something that they are not because of this technology.
I had the same reaction to that film. I just saw Avatar a couple weeks ago, and I was struck by just how intensely identified these people are with their avatars. And it struck me because it's what I have found in researching and reporting this film, is that people really do identify with their digital representations in a very vivid and powerful way. And they can have really profound experiences in virtual worlds. And it sounds really far out to most people to talk about places like Second Life, which is an online virtual world. But it's more and more becoming more and more mainstream. As a matter of fact, we spent some time at IBM, which is holding many of its internal meetings now in virtual worlds. So they will have employees from all over the world meet on a regular basis around a virtual conference table as avatars. And they've saved close to $1 million in travel costs in the last year by doing this. So you can see that, you know, when a company like IBM starts embracing this, it's really the harbinger of things to come.
And the difference there, people might think, well, how is that so different from a video conference? But in fact, people can sort of move off into a group of two or three and have their own conversation.
Yes, it's really different because, you know, people feel that they're sharing a physical space, albeit a virtual physical space, when they're in virtual worlds. And I think that makes an enormous difference than just having your head talk to somebody else's head on a screen. You know, when you have an avatar, that avatar can move around in space from, you know, a sandy beach to a campfire to the limb of a tree and sit with another avatar and talk. And you actually can see each other and comment on the way each other looks and change your clothing. And it becomes a kind of version of yourself, not totally unlike the way people see their Facebook pages. You know, this is my representation. This is the way I'm putting myself out there to the world. But I think with an avatar, it can be a much more dimensional experience and therefore much more powerful.
There's been some interesting research about people who make their avatars taller have a greater amount of confidence if they're dealing with a business proposition or some kind of social interaction. It is interesting that this technology gives us the opportunity to sort of look like whatever we want to look like and present a face to the world that may not reflect who we actually are.
Right, and I think it also presents all sorts of opportunities for manipulation. I mean, when you think about it, particularly when you have an avatar that resembles you, which is becoming more and more possible, and you're a corporation and you want to see what is the impact of having someone's avatar, which looks like them, drink a Coke, for example. Turns out that is a very powerful inducement to somebody to want to go out and buy a Coke. It's a very, very powerful. So, you know, the military and major corporations and the government are all really interested in this research, which is looking at the way people blur the virtual and the real and the way that they can identify with their digital selves.
What did you notice about yourself when you checked out World of Warcraft and Second Life? Did you find that you were behaving in different ways than you would have otherwise?
That's a great question. Well, I didn't spend a lot of time in World of Warcraft. I have to say it's a little above my head. My editor.
There's a lot to learn.
My editor is about 15 years younger than me, and so she put her hand up to be the one who played a lot of World of Warcraft, and she's gotten very good at it. I did spend time in Second Life, which I really enjoyed. It took a while to get acclimated, you know, when you go into a virtual world like this and you have to sort of design your avatar and figure out how to fly and move around. It can take a little while, but once I did, I found that it was like almost dreamlike. I did a presentation inside Second Life, and I was in there for about 3 hours. And when I stood up, I really felt like I'd been in another world. It had completely absorbed me, and I felt so emotionally connected to the people that I met in there. It really surprised me because I think I was much more of a cynic when I started this project about whether online relationships could feel as intimate as real-world ones. I think they can. I think it's a different kind of intimacy, but I think they can.
And we know by now that there are relationships that begin online and then sort of translate into the 3D world. That process, though, must be different of converting your Second Life romance to something with a real living, breathing human being.
It happens all the time. A third of female gamers have started a relationship with somebody that they met in the game. It's just an incredible number of people. And there are lots of very happy stories of people who knew each other only virtually for long periods of time and then got married. You know, it seems to work. Who knows how they'll play out over time. But, you know, people spend a lot of time. People who do spend a lot of time in virtual worlds really spend time there. I mean, if you're a serious World of Warcraft player, you might spend 10 to 15 hours a week inside the game, talking to other people inside the game. That's more time than most of us spend with anybody outside of our nuclear family. So those relationships can get pretty profound.
And yet addiction isn't something that we typically worry about too much here, not in the way that they are formally worrying about it in South Korea.
Right. I think there it's partly a question of plumage, you know, how we're gonna name it.
Mm-hmm.
In South Korea, it's called internet addiction. It's classified as a disorder. Here in the U.S., there's a lot more debate about whether it should be classified as a psychiatric disorder. As a matter of fact, the new DSM is going to be coming out in a couple of years, and there's a very lively debate going on right now about whether internet addiction should be included or not. And we just opened our first internet addiction treatment camp in the U.S. in the last 6 months or so, out in, I think it's on the West Coast. That said, I think there's a very, very high number of people in this country who are struggling with internet dependency or compulsive internet use. And if you go online and look for them, you'll find them. There are all sorts of support groups. There's a World of Warcraft addiction support group, and there's all sorts of people, I think, who are struggling with getting lost on the internet.
Rachel,
so I think we are going to have to.
Let me have you stop
point.
Really quick. Rachel
sure,
Dretson
sure, sure.
is my guest. We're talking about the new Frontline special, Digital Nation, back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is filmmaker Rachel Dretson. She produced tonight's Frontline special called Digital Nation, which will air at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Rachel, you were talking about the fact that they're looking at potentially adding internet addiction to the DSM, but there's no consensus yet on whether this is appropriate.
Right. I think it's just a question of whether internet addiction is a byproduct of other problems or whether it's got its own kind of classification. But I think regardless, most people who know somebody who plays video games know that this is a pretty prevalent issue. I encountered so many people while making this film who heard I was doing it and said, oh, you know, my cousin or my nephew or my friend's son, you know, had to quit college because he got so hooked on World of Warcraft. I mean, you hear about it all the time. It disrupts life because it becomes such a consuming hobby. So that I think, is a problem, whether we call it addiction or not.
I think we've known over thousands of years of being part of human society that instant gratification of material desires is ultimately not a good thing for our characters. But this idea of instant gratification of our desire for information, I guess we're still deciding whether it's good or bad, but it certainly is unprecedented. We've never been able to know things right away the way we can now.
That's right. And you think about the repercussions of that in terms of just the way we live our lives. It's just enormous. you know, I think we're going through a gigantic social experiment, all of us together. And it's going to be a long time before we really have any perspective on how it's changed us. But we're right in the middle of it, and most of us feel it. You know, if you think about yourself 3 years ago, before you had email on your phone, your life was very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's amazing is that it's hard to remember that until you stop and say, wait, how long was it that I've been able to do this? Because it now feels like something that you've always had and will continue to need to have.
That's right. I mean, it's amazing to me when I think that 5 years ago, I didn't even have a wireless connection in my house. And so I had to choose to go online. And I think that's a really big shift. You know, we used to have to make a decision to go online. You know, you would either plug your modem in or you would dial up. And now we're just online all the time. As a matter of fact, it's almost part of our bodies. And the sort of separation between going online, and being offline is really blurring for most of us.
What do you think about social media technologies? I've had many lively debates with people about this, and sometimes it seems to be generationally separated. There are people who say things like Facebook and different kinds of communication programs keep people apart, and there are other people who say actually they bring people together and allow for interactions that simply would not take place without the technology.
Right, and I guess I would say it's probably both. I know that sounds like a kind of wishy-washy answer, but in so many cases with digital technology, it's both. You know, the positive, I think, of this kind of networking, social networking, is that you do find people, long-lost people, who you would otherwise have forgotten. And in some cases, that can be a really wonderful experience. I just got contacted by a woman who said she was my babysitter when I was a year old and had photographs of me when I was just a year old. And, I mean, that's kind of amazing when you think about it. On the other hand, I have one of my closest friends told me a story that it was her birthday recently, and she said she must have had 25 happy birthdays on Facebook and no phone calls because people just said happy birthday on her Facebook page, and that was it. They'd done their duty, and she didn't really connect with them. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword, and I think, you know, even taking it a step further, when you look at social relationships, particularly between younger people, sometimes gnarly, awkward things are resolved online that once would have been resolved face-to-face.
Yeah.
And we have to ask ourselves, you know, what do we lose when we do that, when we have a fight online and we never actually see each other? And that happens so frequently.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Chris in Dallas. Hey, Chris.
Hi. My university professor mentioned that you could not be in two places at once. That's something she always told us, more relating to being in two meetings at once. But how does that relate to a student being in a classroom listening to a lecture, being on Facebook and sending a text message? Are they able to be in three places at once?
That's a great question. That's a really, really good question. Actually, they're not. I mean, what brain researchers would tell you is that when you think you're multitasking, what you're actually doing is switching very quickly between different tasks. So your brain can do two things at once if you're, for example, chopping vegetables while listening to the radio, because that's two different parts of your brain. But if you're actually in a lecture and you're trying to listen to the lecture and you're also on Facebook and G-chatting or whatever it is, you're actually just moving from one thing to another. And so you're not really literally in two places at once or doing two things at one time.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak next with Kathy in Plano. Hello, Kathy.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chris. First of all, I want to thank you for allowing this speaker on the program because it's a topic that has been really important to me. I've actually played Warcraft and EverQuest, and I've done this for about 10 years. And I do want to, I'm sorry if I'm backtracking here, do want to make a comment about how this internet, you know, is considered like an addiction. But I need for people to realize that an addiction is not just only gaming. I mean, it could be anything that you take way farther than you normally do. Like, you know, for example, you know, gambling, alcoholism. It's just you focus on internet and gaming as opposed to, you know, other things. But in general, though, I do want to say that people need to realize that they also delve into this kind of thing because they're escaping some kind of issue that they're having in their real life. Another reason a lot of people spend time on this stuff is because it is a cheap substitution for entertainment. You pay $15 a month to get onto Warcraft, And, you know, you're not going to the movies and, you know, dropping $30 for popcorn tickets, et cetera. But I do want, you know, maybe if you can just maybe point into that kind of research and take it from that perspective.
Yeah, interesting points. Thanks for your call, Kathy. Is this maybe just another form of entertainment? Maybe we're not watching as much TV anymore. We're online instead.
Well, I think what you'll find, actually, when you look at the research, is that a lot of people are doing both. You know, they're
simultaneously.
They're simultaneous. I mean, my husband and I both, when we sit down in front of the TV, we generally reflexively open our laptops because, God forbid, we would just watch television. You know, we have to multitask. And I think that's actually pretty common. So I'm not sure that one is replacing the other. Of course, a lot of people do watch television online now. A lot of people will watch my show online, streaming live as we speak, so... you know, these things are getting blurred, television and the internet.
And there's a certain amount, too, of social pressure. You know, it used to be people were, when cell phones first came out, people would be upset because they could be contacted by clients and bosses and different people when they were supposedly off the clock. Nowadays, it's not uncommon, you know, I'll answer work emails on a Sunday and then get a response from the person that I've sent it to because everybody's sort of working all the time.
I know. Isn't it amazing? And if you don't respond, you know, people get horrified.
What, are you taking the weekend off?
Yeah. Exactly. So it's not so easy to disconnect anymore. You know, people just have this expectation that you're online all the time. And if they don't hear from you, they go crazy. It has blurred the lines very much between work and you know, life. And I, you know, as someone who for many years worked out of my home and has small children, you know, I recognize that this can be a good thing because I'm able to do my work from my home because I have the internet. And I produced much of this film for the first time, actually, remotely. My editor would upload cuts of the film, and I would give her notes, and we would G-chat. And, I mean, we had Google Docs open all the time and collaborated on scripts remotely. And, you know, it was quite amazing, and it enabled me to be home. But it also meant that I was never really not working. And that's something I think my kids, you know, notice and we've talked about, and I need to sort of create boundaries. I've tried very hard to do that to make them feel that there's time where I'm not working.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and I've dealt with that too, where you're physically present and you're there if somebody, you know, chops off an important body part while making dinner, but you may not be fully engaged in the way you would if you came home from the office.
That's right. And you know, it's a tricky thing being a parent, particularly I think as a woman, because you know, you're always trying to just to juggle. And the internet lets us do that, I think, in ways that can be very liberating and also a little bit confusing sometimes.
Have you, since taking on this project, and maybe since the 2007 film, adjusted the way you make rules for your kids' use of technology?
To a certain extent, it has. The main thing that I think it's affected is my attitude about distraction and attention and focus, which was something I really didn't think much about before. I thought more about, you know, are my kids going to see things they shouldn't online? Is a predator going to find them? You know, those kinds of questions. Now it's much more about this notion of paying attention to each other. And so I have tried very hard to ban electronic media from our time together in the evenings because it's kind of during the week, it's the only time we're really all together. And so my husband and I, we're the ones who really have to struggle, not my kids. We have to, you know, keep our cell phones and our laptops away and resist the impulse to check them or to pick them up when they ring. And I think it's a good thing for our kids because they're obviously, we're modeling for them. And I want them to see that we can do that, even though it's hard, and pick up on that for their own lives.
We have time for another call, and this time we'll speak with Will in Dallas. Hello, Will.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I have kind of a question of where, well, let me explain myself. I'm 23, and I'm not that much of a techie person. I'm not a Luddite. I looked up your number on my BlackBerry to call the show. Mm-hmm. But where do people like me left? Everyone expects young people to be so good at everything and to love spending time on the internet. You know, I've had bosses that just assume I can fix something on their computer because I'm 23. And people almost see, there's almost an idea that I might be lazy or stupid because I don't know how to do all this stuff, but it's kind of, I just don't like to. I like to read and be outside. You know, is there a place for people like that?
I think there is, but you're right. It's probably getting harder and harder to find your kind as people get more and more wired. I mean, I did meet some. I went to MIT to do some filming, and I met some students who really sort of set themselves apart, you know, deliberately from the culture of being wired all the time and took some pride in it. And, you know, I think there are people of all ages who are trying to do that, but it there isn't a lot of tolerance for it, I think, in this culture because we do have this expectation of each other. But I think it's great what you're trying to do, and you should keep it up. You know, it's as long as you're not missing it, you know, you're probably finding all sorts of things that other people don't get to find out because you're not online all the time.
It will be really interesting once this generation, the millennials who are now in college, are, you know, teaching college classes and they're at that age, and see how different the classroom looks then.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Well, I know with teachers, you know, in secondary school, there's going to be a million new teachers coming in, a million teachers are retiring in the next, I don't know how many years, and so there's going to be a gigantic influx of probably younger and more wired teachers teaching students, and I think that's going to drastically change the landscape.
You give us a lot of pros and cons here of this technology. Obviously, there are things, and we didn't even talk about it, but one really interesting segment of the film is about a school that has really turned itself around, a failing school, by encouraging kids to get engaged in technology. Did you start the project hoping that you would end it with a clear sense of whether this was good or bad?
You know, I've probably been making films for too long to think I could conclude something that that clearly. But I think I hoped that I would have more hard information, hard data to call on. And that was really one of the more surprising and disappointing aspects of this process, was that there just wasn't science out there saying, you know, what is this doing to my brain? How many hours should my kids be online? You know, does it hurt you to be looking at a screen for 8 hours a day? It's just not done. And I had hoped that would sort of help me figure out, as a parent particularly, how to handle this stuff. And I get asked, now people turn to me because I've been working on it for so long, and they tell me, you know, they ask me, well, what should I do? And so, you know, I think we're all, unfortunately, in this together. We have to muddle through. And where I've kind of landed is the most important thing right now is to have some awareness, try to get a little bit of distance on this, enough just to see it and to see how profound its impact is on us. Just that kind of mindfulness, I think, is a step forward. And to initiate conversations about it, both on and offline conversations about it, I think is really key. I want to put in a plug for our website, which we've been building for the last year. We actually reported this story online before we reported it as a film. And we have a gigantic website that is filled with resources, both for parents and teachers, submissions from viewers. We've had people submit their own digital stories over the past year. We've got hundreds of stories on there, plus tons and tons of readings and clips and footage. And just, it's a really deep, rich resource. And I hope that people will watch the show and then get online and share their own thoughts and experiences about the digital world.
And we do have a link to that from our website so people can find it easily. Rachel Dretson is producer of tonight's Frontline special, Digital Nation, airs at 9 o'clock. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.